All lines are now bridged.
Okay, thank you, and hello, everyone. My name is Mike Berry. I'm with ONC, and thank you for joining the Interoperability Standards Priorities Task Force with us today, and we really appreciate everyone's attendance and for joining us, and especially the task force and our co-chairs for all their hard work and putting together their thoughts for this important program. We do have some special guests with us today from Audacious Inquiry that the co-chairs will introduce shortly. But I'm going to start our meeting with roll call. So when I call your name, if you could please indicate your presence, that would be great. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Ari and Malik.
Good morning in my time.
David McCauley.
Good afternoon in Central Time.
Ricky Bloomfield. Cynthia Fisher.
Present.
Valerie Gray. Jim Gerges.
Present.
Edward June. Ken Kalamoto.
Hello.
Victor Lee.
Present.
Leslie Leonard. Glenn McDonald. Jack Poe. Raj Watwani. Ram Sharam. Sasha Termont. Andy Truscott.
Present.
And Scott Weingarten. Okay, if I missed your name, then I will keep track of the attendance and that you were here.
I see a lot of folks who are listed as participants in the meeting, so I'm wondering whether we're having folks with connectivity issues.
Right. All right. Ari and David, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
All right. Well, I think we're going to start off with a bang, with a senior presentation, which is better than the reverse. I think Keith looked at the fire puns and discovered that we just didn't have enough puns in the HIT community. So he really wanted to double down on additional puns. But we're going to hear from Keith and Lauren Kneeser, and Scott Osfeld as well, from Audacious Inquiry, who are the program leaders, enterprise architect, and head of AI, respectively, or somewhat respectively, to talk to us about SANR and situational awareness, which is one of the proposed priority areas. At the conclusion of that presentation, then we're going to run through the output of our priority process voting and do a group discussion about where we end up with priority process. And then if we're ambitious enough, we will pick up and discuss homework. But with that, I'll turn it over to David to introduce our SANR participants.
I think you've done a great job of setting the stage, so I'll just turn it over to, I believe, Lauren, you're going to lead the presentation, and Keith will be color commentary, but you guys feel free to do it however you want. So hopefully you're all set, and there are your slides, so take it away.
Great, thanks. And this is Lauren Kneiser. I'll actually have Keith introduce himself first and then maybe turn it to me.
So hi, guys, and especially some of you old friends. This is Keith Thune. I'm an enterprise architect at Audacious Inquiry, and I've been involved in interoperability standards throughout the past 15 years, starting with CDA and CCDA, and then over the last 5 years working in HL7 Fire, where I'm presently working on three different fire implementation guides, including the SANR IG, and have been involved in past development in fire IGs and the core fire standard itself. And I'd say it's also Lauren Kneiser.
My apologies.
You're not the first to mess it up. Thank you. So great. Thanks. As Keith said, my name is Lauren Kneiser. I'm the Director of Emergency Preparedness and Response at Audacious Inquiry. And before coming to the company a little more than a year ago, I was a federal employee, like perhaps many of you on this call. And I worked for HHS at the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. And one of my roles there in operational response was as the Information Management Section Chief in the Secretary's Operations Center. And in that role, I really had a front row seat to a lot of the challenges at the local, state, and federal level with regards to healthcare situational awareness. So this topic is something I'm very passionate about. I've had a great time working with Keith this year on the SANR project, and we're excited to present our progress to you today. Next slide, please. Great, thank you. And so before we get into the technical detail, which I will leave to Keith, I'd like to give just a big picture operational context, since I think the operations and the technology really need to go hand in hand to be successful. So as most of America knows now, during COVID-19, hospitals and public health authorities have a limited visibility on healthcare capacity, supply, and staffing across facilities. And this is particularly true when we're looking at a regional level or outside of one's own network or hospital system. The challenge here is that it complicates patient transfers, evacuations, and the ability to take care of a patient surge while also maintaining essential routine healthcare services. And today, the responsibility to load balance or to move patients from one system to another really falls on the healthcare facility, and there's not a trusted central entity that has visibility of capacity at a regional level. The challenge is exacerbated by the fact that technical infrastructure that the facilities rely on for load balancing is very fragmented and often very specific to a hospital or a healthcare system. And while we do have state-level systems today, as you've likely all seen in the news over the last year, these systems tend to be manually populated and can be very burdensome for hospitals and healthcare facilities to populate with any regular frequency. Furthermore, there's no national or federal standard for the exchange of healthcare situational awareness information during disasters and public health emergencies. And this is true both for essential elements of information, we call EEIs in the response community, as well as for the underlying technical infrastructure that you all on this call think about much more frequently than I do. Next slide, please. Okay, great. So my next three slides, I'm actually going to just tick through really quickly. You have the content and can review it on your own time, but I really wanted to drive home the point here that this is not a COVID-19 specific problem. This is a problem that we in the response community have experienced for certainly my entire career and well before that. So this is just an example from an after action report from 9/11 and the attack on the Pentagon specifically. Next slide. A second example here from Hurricane Katrina, where there was a big challenge evacuating patients before, during, and after the incident. Next slide. Yet another example from H1N1. And I will pause here for a moment just to highlight a finding from Dr. Eric Toner at Johns Hopkins University that highlights the fact that obviously situational awareness is very important for direct patient care decision making, but it's also critically important for the way that we make policy decisions. And having been in that seat in the Secretary's Operations Center, I can tell you from firsthand knowledge, it's extremely difficult to make data-informed decisions when you don't know what's happening on the ground. It's very difficult to know where to send limited resources, when to execute policy waivers, and when to implement other program flexibilities that you might have to alleviate pressure on the healthcare system. Next slide. Great, thanks. And so this is just a report from the University of North Carolina that I thought summarized really well a lot of the challenges in the healthcare system as it pertains to hospital capacity reporting. We, with the SANR project, are aiming to address many, if not all, of these challenges. So I'm just going to tick through them very quickly. The first is that the systems that exist today, like I said, are variable in scope, and they weren't really built to communicate with each other. The second is that we don't have a common language or parsing system for reporting data from across these different IT infrastructures. The third is that we often lack human resources or people who know how to analyze and aggregate data as it's coming in and turn it into information that is operationally useful for decision making. And finally, like I said before, we have inconsistent and perhaps non-existent standards for health information exchange during disasters. Next slide, please. Okay, so one more disaster example for you. Like I said, there are plenty of them to draw from. I included this one after Hurricane Harvey for a specific reason. As you can see here, Texas during Harvey was hit. The entire Gulf Coast was affected. Many of you probably remember the stories coming out of Houston. And in this incident, patients were evacuated, and many of them went quite a long distance. They went into Louisiana. They went up north into the state. And this report shows that there was a healthcare surge as far away as Dallas, which is several hundred miles away, several hours driving distance from Houston and the coast. And, you know, I like to put this in here just to highlight the fact that when we think about health IT systems for situational awareness, we need to be thinking about systems that can scale up or scale down, depending on the magnitude of the incident that we're talking about. And, you know, it doesn't show it on the map. It cuts Louisiana off here. But I think it's also critically important to remember that we need to be able to share data across state lines. And often when we fund programs for systems like this, we funnel the money down to a state level, and the funding has to stay within those state borders. But that's just simply not the way that people access healthcare in America. Next slide. All right, so I'm going to shift gears here and talk a little bit about policy. I think it's really important, if you all are not aware of this legislation, to be aware of it. And so there actually is enabling legislation that authorizes the Secretary of HHS, in collaboration with state, local, and tribal public health officials, to establish a near real-time electronic nationwide public health situational awareness capability. And this language was first authorized in 2006. It was reauthorized in 2013, and it was reauthorized in 2019. And it still remains in effect today. Importantly, there is a funding line, a budget line, also authorized with the legislation, although to my knowledge, I don't believe it's ever been appropriated. Next slide. All right, and you can see that GAO has been very direct with their feedback as to the progress that HHS has made toward the system. Their 2017 report is called HHS Has Made Little Progress Toward Implementing Enhanced Situational Awareness Network Capabilities. And they really say it better than I can, so I'm just going to read a quote from one of the reports on the screen here. Excuse me. It reads, HHS developed an implementation plan. However, the actions identified in the plan did not address all of the required activities, such as defining data elements and standards. Until the department addresses the required activities, it will lack an effective tool for ensuring that public health situational awareness network capabilities have been established in accordance with the law. Next slide. All right, great. And so that brings us up pretty much to the beginning of next year and pretty much to the beginning of the COVID-19 response. And at that time, I had just joined AI, I think about 6 weeks prior. I was still very new. And in early March of 2020, we learned that ADT networks were being considered as a mechanism for potential healthcare situational awareness system. And ADT is the core business of what AI does, and so that should have been pretty exciting for us. But it actually, we found it pretty unsettling. And the reason for that is several years before, AI actually wrote an analysis commissioned by ASPR. I was not involved at the time, didn't actually even know this report existed until then. But a main finding of that report was that FHIR was very likely a superior methodology to ADT for hospital capacity reporting. And at the time, we did bring this up to the COVID-19 task force, but there wasn't really a formal mechanism for a public-private partnership or to continue the work in any way. And so we began the work of collaborating with industry partners in a much more grassroots way as the SANER project. And Keith has really been at the helm of that initiative all year, so I will turn it to him from here to give you more detail on where we are.
Thank you, Lauren. So if we can go to the next slide. So I first started talking to people in industry about this a little bit more than a year ago. And actually, Arian was one of the people that I had reached out to about this particular challenge. When we started the SANER project, we called it Situational Awareness for Novel Epidemic Response. And then, Arian's right, I did look and see what the acronym was, but it was a very happy accident. we were looking at the crazy that was being reported by our customers, or customers' customers, about having to staff up or take staff time to be able to manually report on all of this situational awareness. In fact, in one case, I spoke to somebody at a hospital who was having to manually handle a lot of this reporting. When down in the basement, some of the previous standards that I'll talk about when we get to the history were still in use but weren't actually being used to support the COVID reporting. So we go to the next slide. For those of you who lived through this, HITECH's grandfather was AHIC, the American Health Information Community. It was a federal advisory committee that preceded this by at least one ancestor. And their job was to create use cases, which would be the focus of standardization efforts in ANSI-HITSB. They had in 2005 issued an emergency responder use case. They added an addenda to it in 2006 to really address situational awareness reporting. And as a result, those of us who were working on this use case in HITSB, we called this the Katrina use case. And yes, we had other use cases. We had the bird flu use case and the anthrax use case as well. Where what we were trying to address was what was the problem of the last year where standardization could help. HITSB put together a publication called the Resource Utilization Component, which was supposed to be a standard to be able to report on bed availability in emergency departments on diversion. And to support that, we used the OASIS Open EDXL and HAVE standards in that publication. That was informed by and then later fed back into some of the HAVE bed specifications that had been developed by AHRQ and ASPR and were in use from 2005 to about 2016 in the hospital preparedness program. And then that program stopped requiring hospitals to report, I think, around 2016, 2017. Subsequently, HL7 and OASIS Open collaborated together on HAVE 2.0 to improve the HAVE standard to address some of the shortcomings in it that had been discovered in the implementations of HAVBED and HAVE previously. If we go to the next slide. Where that falls down in the COVID-19 epidemic is that we realized we needed to know not just about beds, but about ventilators or in other disasters, other kinds of things that you would need to treat patients that might be in short supply. We also wanted to understand how that was impacting deaths due to the emergency. How many patients were actually catching the disease in the hospital versus out? How much of that capacity in the hospital is related to COVID versus other things going on? What was going on with lab testing results? How often were tests being performed on a daily basis? And then what were the outcomes? Also looking at, do you have enough staff to do your work? Do you have enough supplies to be able to do the work? These were rolling out. They started rolling out in March, and by April and May, there were like four different modules that had been rolled out. And the first one, the patient impact and hospital capacity, needed to be refined to further clarify for people, well, what do we mean by the patient died? And this is one of the first emergencies in, I would say, a very, very long time where the issue at hand was actually resulting from an emergency that was being impacting at a national scale and a global scale. We go to the next slide. In developing the specifications, one of the insights that we came up with was that what we're actually doing is process control. These essential elements of information that emergency preparedness and response agencies are asking for are measurements of capacity or utilization, events that are occurring, links of queues, how many people are waiting for service, how many people are waiting to get into a bed, how many people are waiting to be discharged, average service times. So if you looked at, as testing proceeded and the pace of testing got faster and faster, how long it actually took to get results was indicative of stress on the system, because you could do the test, but you couldn't result faster than you had people to do the evaluation of the results or the other resources. So being able to look at average service times. And then also needing to be able to put facilities into different groups to address status. Like in a local emergency, I'm accepting patients who are on diversion, or in this national emergency, are you like in a red, yellow, green status with respect to available staff to treat patients or your PPE supplies? We get to the next slide. In looking at this, we looked at sort of the whole workflow and what would need to happen to support this. The first things was making sure that the public health and emergency response agencies were defining those measures at a level of detail, right down to what are the link codes that tell me what tests you're interested in, or what are the SNOMED CT codes that tell me what symptoms you're interested in reviewing for suspected COVID patients in the definition of the measure. That then enables the hospitals and other healthcare provider organizations to be able to collect and compute that data automatically from the relevant information systems, and I put the accent on the S there, because your EHR doesn't have PPE data. That's going to be in inventory management. It may not know what's going on with your workforce. That might be in your workforce management. And your ICU central monitoring solution is going to have much more real-time access to who's on event than might happen if you don't have that system integrated into your EHR, and so those observations aren't necessarily flowing automatically in, and you have to wait until the shift end when somebody enters an order for ventilation in order to find out that you've got a patient on a ventilator. So we needed the ability to collect all of that data in the hospital and then aggregate and publish that data to local public health and emergency response officials through what we call the local public health network, but you could think of that as, you know, your health information exchange or some state or federal level public health networking system, for example, NHSN. And then be able to share that data at the local level and do it in such a way that you might also be able to have the locals share with the state share with the feds, and have them have the capacity to, as necessary, maybe able to reduce what's needed locally to what the state is asking for, or what's needed at the state level to what the feds are asking for. Because another complaint we heard from some of our hospital customers and some other folks that I've been talking to was, we have to report this out, and we have to report this in New York City. We have to report it to HRDS in the state, and then it also has to go to HHS, and then there's a separate report that has to go to FEMA. So a pretty significant challenge for hospitals to have to handle that multiple reporting. Wouldn't it be nice if the locals could report to the state what's needed, the state could report to the federal government, and at the policy level, we could have federal and maybe state standards to say, these are the essential elements of information that we want to be able to collect and have them build on each other. Let's go to the next slide. So what we tried to build in the SANER IG was a way to have a complete reporting approach. where you could take your non-API-enabled systems, such as your bed management solution or your ICU central monitoring, be able to query its database, produce a CSV file and push that to a RESTful endpoint, and have that data be recorded in a measure report, or where you've got API-enabled solutions to be able to read that definition, do the right queries using standards such as those based on US CDI and FHIR R4, automate the computation by building some consistency around how you compute different kinds of measures, looking at different kinds of process control measures, and then store that in a report, and then have that be able to be aggregated up by that server in the hospital, push it off to local or state public health agencies, and also be able to be used by the hospitals for local command and control so that they can see that broader picture. We go to the next slide. In the process of developing this implementation guide, which was supported very early on by ONC, we saw that there was an opportunity through the STAR HIE grants and work with Texas Health Service Authorities to apply for one of these STAR HIE grants to pilot test this, because not only do you need the standard, but you actually have to prove out that it works. And so we're supporting THSA and HASA, another HIE in Texas, working together with THSA to do a pilot of the SANER IG. Just recently, THSA issued an RFP to support open source development of Smart on Fire app and a SANER server to support that automated data exchange. And that particular project has both a technical and policy advisory group that includes membership not just at the state level in Texas, but also local agencies, vendors, and federal agencies. We have routine participation weekly from people from CDC and U.S. Digital Service, where we're allowed, where we're able to talk about the different kinds of things that we're thinking about and learning about the kinds of experiences that others have had at that national level, and then also being able to provide that feedback to those federal agencies. We go to the next slide. So just to sort of recap, we have a way to automate computation of measures through FHIR, be able to pull data in from non-FHIR-based systems through very simple CSV integrations, aggregate the data from multiple sources because there isn't a single hospital information system that has it all in a lot of cases. Looking at applying process control science and measurement to what folks in the emergency response field think of as their essential elements of information. We identified very early that we needed to be able to stratify by social determinants of health, such as age, gender, race, ethnicity, and geography, but also understood that there were other ways to stratify and look at the data with respect to outcomes and health risk factors and comorbidity that would allow us to better understand what was going on with the COVID disease process and see who's impacted. One of the pieces of ballot feedback that we received was, well, measures are great, but we want to be able to see line-level data as well, because you might have two hospitals that are at 85% capacity and similarly sized, but one of them could be dealing with a variant of COVID where their patients in the ICU are much more severe cases and going to be there longer. So you need potentially to be able to risk adjust the measures based on that line level data. And then building out open source implementations and making sure that those are tested over various connectathon and testing events. Get to the next slide. I was very heartened to see very early on in the development of the work of the Sainer project that it was actually identified in the ISA, the Interoperability Standards Advisory, last year. And I wanted to give you my thoughts on where it's going to be at soon with respect to that advisory. So we're looking to have the standard for trial use published by HL7. That's estimated to be sometime in May 2021, so that would be at balloted draft. We talked about the THSA STAR HIE pilot, which is currently a pilot in progress. But I've also been working with IHE and others in the IHE who are working on development of an IHE profile that looks to use the Sainer IG in IHE profile development. And the lead of that effort is Keith Parker from HealthCurrent in Arizona. He's another STAR HIE participant. So I'm expecting to see other pilot activity from yet another STAR HIE participant as well. I have to say adoption is low because we don't even have the published STU. How can you have adoption if you don't have the final standard? But we've seen some very promising efforts, and I'll talk about those on the next slide. I laugh at this next one. Sorry, if you go back to the previous slide, I was not quite done there. I laugh at this next one because it says to be federally required, it has to be called out in a federal regulation or a grant, and it is specifically called out in the grant. Realistically, it's not federally required. It's required for that specific grant. The work that's happening both in IHE and HL7 is going to be a free standard, and there will all be open source implementations. And we also spent some time with MITRE in the first two connective funds working a lot on testing. And so test tool availability is available through the MITRE-developed Inferno Community Edition. So now if we go to the next slide. And talk a little bit about the industry support for the efforts. We've been involved now in this project in three different HL7 connectathons, as well as the IHE North American connectathon. Had very, very strong support in HL7. This project was initiated March 23rd of last year as a project proposal in HL7, and within 2 weeks, we had approvals from six different governing bodies within HL7, probably the fastest project scope statement approval in HL7 history. Strong support in all of the connectathons, not just the IHE connectathons, but also the HL7 connectathons from IHE USA. And as I said, the first two connectathons, we worked closely with MITRE to make sure that there was testing support. And in about mid-April of last year, the HIMSS EHRA sent out a letter of support for Sainer to 12 different federal agencies, including ONC, which we'd be happy to send you a copy of as well if you don't already have that with our other materials, strongly supporting the work of the HL7 Sainer implementation guide. We look to the next slide. So to wrap up, you know, I think some things that would be very helpful for dealing with COVID-19 and for other disasters is if this work that's happening with the Sainer IG continues to get support for development and piloting by federal agencies, by ONC, for example, is through the STAR HIE grant, or by CDC, through other grants to states or ASPR or other agencies. Want to make sure that there's greater collaboration among, you know, those of us who are in the health IT interoperability space, but also those who are working in the disaster response communities, to make sure we're better aligning the subject matters experts on essential elements of information for healthcare and making sure that they fit well into the technical standards and the information infrastructure that's available for hospitals, making sure that's really lined up. Recognizing, as I think both Lauren and I have said a couple of different times, that you know, this isn't about just COVID-19. This, you know, hurricanes in Texas, forest fires or rolling blackouts in California, everybody can benefit from being able to support greater situational awareness. We heard from a healthcare agency where we're working with in Boston about some of the real, very real challenges making sure that SDOH data is included in that reporting, and you'll actually find in some of the work that's done in CARES Act, requirements for states to be reporting and federal agencies being reporting to HHS data that's broken down by age and gender and race and ethnicity and geography to address that ongoing need for SDOH data to understand about healthcare disparities. And then lastly, we've done a lot of work on St. IG, working with EHR vendors and infrastructure vendors, interface engine vendors, and organizations like CDC, NHSN, to make sure that we get a lot of the clinical data. We'd love to see more done to foster engagement with healthcare supply chain and workforce vendors. And so we've started some outreach on those sides, but you know, any available assistance that we can get would be appreciated. And so at this point, I think we've reached an opportunity for you all to ask questions.
Hey, thank you so much.
That
was a fantastic presentation. Really appreciate the history in this space. You know, maybe a question for, I'll tell you what went through my head as we were thinking through this presentation, which is, Keith, I have no doubt with the work that you've done that we can land a standard that solves the capability needs for situational awareness in emergency response. And I have no doubt from, I think, Lauren's upfront presentation that whether it's wildfires here in California or hurricanes in the Gulf Coast or you know, earthquakes here in California or tornadoes in David's neck of the woods, that emergency response is an ever-present need independent of COVID-19. I think David could provide you the best attestation for why a multi-state approach is necessary, that just lining up in state boundaries isn't that helpful when you've got, you know, a major city that literally straddles two state boundaries. Where my head was going was maybe to Lauren to think through the policy levers that are in play. And again, if you just think through Keith's history of standards development, and this is not unusual. This is not a critique of public health readiness or emergency and disaster readiness. It's an endemic problem in the U.S. healthcare system. The question that comes to my mind is policy alignment and incentive alignment, and what policy levers are needed to make sure that the ecosystem of standards adopters, you know, to Keith's point, it's not just the EHRs, and so you can't just pull on the EHR certification program. You've got HR IS systems. You've got supply chain management systems. You know, what are the policy levers that are required? How do those policy levers distribute nationally versus state? And where are both the funding mechanisms and economic incentive mechanisms that would be required to have standards adoption deploy at the level of scale that would be required to have a future emergency fully informed with dashboards that allow for emergency response?
Thanks. This is Lauren. Luckily, I've spent a fair amount of time thinking about that question and actually been involved in several initiatives out of ASPR with the National Academies of Medicine asking somewhat similar questions. So I'm going to start with the easy levers because obviously that's a nice place to start. I think first and foremost, if we are accepting the state boundary restriction, which is, you know, where it's the environment we're in today, the way that funding is flowing from the federal government to state governments, there are some things that we could do to move us in the right direction. For example, the grants and cooperative agreements that states are currently leveraging to be more prepared, the HPP program, the FET program, the Homeland Security Grant Program under DHS, all of those programs allow for funding to be used for situational awareness systems, and most, if not all, of the states and territories actually are spending some of those dollars for their statewide systems. But there's not currently very many, if any, parameters around what those systems need to do. And so I think, you know, a very proximal solution to at least start with would be to use those grant programs to implement some of these standards or require some of these standards if they're going to expend funding on situational awareness systems. So that's recognizing, you know, the restrictions that we currently have and trying to work within the current rules. Obviously, like you said, the challenge of policy that is expansive enough to allow for national adoption of some sort of standard that crosses state lines is super challenging. I do think we could start from a policy perspective back with the PAPA, the PAPRA, and the PAPAYA legislation. That legislation requires the funding to go to state health departments, but if funding were able to go to other entities that have a stake in this challenge, for example, hospital associations or even directly to healthcare systems, we might be able to, you know, get around the state boundary challenge. And then the other suggestion I would have is, you know, we're thinking very much top down here. And if we think bottom up and think about the fact that these systems that we're proposing and the standards that we're proposing might actually be useful on a daily basis for healthcare systems to do their more routine load balancing. For example, in urban areas, you know, where you've got traffic incidents or, you know, large structure fires, or even for seasonal flu where there's a surge every single year. And start getting these health systems to use a standard for those more routine use cases, we might be able to expand into the non-routine.
Awesome. So, and then that last one sort of proposes the perpetual problem of how do you compete against people picking up phones and faxing people that they know how to do and get them to adopt and use more electronic dashboarding methods. So I think I sort of parsed the first part of your question as there are existing grant programs, and at least a pretty obvious thing to do would be to tie those granting programs to a condition of participation for granting programs to standards adoption would be, you know, the if you think about top-down levers, that would be the most obvious top-down lever. Okay. I see, David, I don't know if you want to jump in with questions using using chair's prerogative, but I see that Les has a hand up.
Yeah, let me ask one quick question of Keith. I hope it's a simple question. Keith, it wasn't clear to me what the work output of SANER will be in terms of is it just the spec for the transactions or is it the system code that would do the aggregation and dashboarding? What's the scope of the work technically?
So there's a couple of different scopes that we need to look at. There's the implementation guide effort that is being developed through HL7. That's going to be the technical specification and framework for the standard that is used. Then there is the broader SANER project that AI is sort of sponsored that is driving forward that work in HL7. and devoting resources and time to put together the ballots and do the editorial work and convene the meetings through HL7. But also then build out open source tools. So we've already released an open source tool that has actually been picked up now and expanded on by Leidos with NHSN to demonstrate their capacity to receive the information, and that's built on Happy on Fire open source fire server to be able to essentially receive the reports. And further in the STAR HIE pilots, where we're working closely with THSA, yet more open source to be able to support these pilots. And so that's sort of part of the broader what we're trying to do from our perspective to enhance and advance situational awareness, is actually be able to deliver tools that can make this stuff work. Because it's one thing to deliver the standard and expect everybody to implement it, but you also need the infrastructure and technology to go along with that, and then build up around that organizations who are familiar with it, who know how to deploy it, manage it, et cetera. And so trying to build out that infrastructure.
Right. And just to follow up on that, Keith.
Great.
Sorry, just to follow up on that, Keith. You know, my understanding of the architecture for Saner is that it at least contemplates that there are networks that are associated with this. So it's not just a, hey, go implement this at a hospital level and everything works. It's, you know, there might be a state HIE in the mix, or there might be an aggregator in the mix who sort of serves as a destination point and a routing point into both state and federal areas for situational awareness, and might also to Lauren's previous point, provide a regional dashboard.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a huge role in here for example for health information exchanges, which already many have very close relationships with state public health. And then as we heard, for example, in a presentation from OCHIN 2 days ago, where they were supporting ECR across multiple states, you know, another network like that would be able to support something like situational awareness in multiple places.
Okay, let's go to long-suffering Les.
Yeah, hi. Nice to talk to you again, Keith. It's been a few years. Back when I was at the CDC and running BioSense and other things, we spent a lot of time thinking about situational awareness and all hazards preparedness, since then there's been a lot of work in this area about, you know, how to get ready for a wide variety of things. And just, you know, because I kind of go to the most practical aspect, the hurricane you were referencing blew into Texas or whatever it is, the first thing you can find out about an infrastructure is which hospitals stop reporting data. That's actually a very practical issue, because the internet goes down, or that they don't have enough bandwidth to use systems that are very high data volume. They have to go to a satellite backup. We've been very fortunate in the COVID-19 experience to have a slow-moving disaster that doesn't disrupt our infrastructure too much. In fact, it's allowed us to make more investments in infrastructure. I think architecture. Second point I'd make is that I think architecture and, you know, mapping onto what has worked previously is very important in meaningful use. We were able to make under that, at least, we were able to make substantial advances in situational awareness by requiring, or, you know, incentivizing the creation of a syndromic surveillance message, and that wound up bringing up thousands of hospitals into the BioSense program while it was running, and then, you know, budget cuts and other things like that kind of set that back. But that was based on a single, you know, one standard outbound messages going to cloud-based resource that was segmented by state, and that I point out to that kind of architecture is working really well. Now, what can I say didn't work so well? The original BioSense infrastructure, which is very similar to what you were proposing, put a server at each hospital and then standardized data mapping into that server to then, you know, aggregate it up the supply chain. It had some errors in it. It did not include state and local resources specifically in their mapping up. It routed directly to the feds, and then we tried to route down from the feds. But that was a problem, and the data mapping was not consistent, and as a result, the data were often uninterpretable. Now, I think we've made a lot of strides in the research community in particular in standardized repositories that are behind institutional firewalls that can be queried in federated ways. And that I think that that's a very exciting architecture. But if you want to get a big bang for the buck on something that can matter right now, it might be better to focus on outbound V2X style HL7 communications to a central authority, whatever that is, and that at a cloud or whatever. And let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Let's build from what we learned with syndromic surveillance and the wide existing capacities for that. Because if you could emulate that in some small way, you would be doing better than what you're doing now. Now,
so that's a fair commentary, Les. And I would note that BioSense and some of the other HL7 V2 based are really good at being able to get at some of that critical data. I think you probably saw Farzad Mastashari's alerts about what was going on New York on the basis of some of what he was seeing based on very similar solutions. What we're learning from this, though, is that it's not just the clinical data about what's going on. It's very hard to get at what's your bed capacity from ADT messages. You know about the admits, but you don't necessarily know what's being done to expand the bed capacity. What HL7 version 2 message is actually going to tell you anything about PPE or ventilator utilization? It's not there.
I completely agree with you. Just let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Let's get
not going there at all. There's a lot that we can learn from what's been done.
Well, and let's do what we can do immediately. Let's not, you know, wait for that. But then secondly, I agree with you that the idea of a fire server at each institution for public health would be a great idea. In fact, we've written about this already with the CDC in the context of replacing a lot of notifiable conditions with this, with the idea of a searchable fire server, and that I think that it's a great idea to do that. And it parallels.
So we called that we called that the SANER serverless, and yes, we are using a fire server to support that capacity.
Okay.
But it has really one function. It's not designed to be an all-purpose fire server for the hospital. A hospital could certainly take if they had an all-purpose fire server to accomplish that. But that could also be, quite honestly, a network appliance that is really just to support that public health reporting need and the ability to aggregate and collect the data and send it forward. Or it could be something that exists in, as we've seen from several of the interface engine vendors, an interface that is supported to accomplish that.
Well, it's not just a SANER appliance, because I don't think it should be, because there are many needs for public health for this type of data, and that there does need to be some governance around that. And I, you know, refer you to the work we published with Georgia Tech on this. John Duke here. Going forward from the idea of an appliance, and again, this is, you know, close to what the original BioSense implementation was, that I think it's a good idea. Now, when you're looking at the right architectural models for this, I think you learn a lot by looking at research networks like Trinetics or I2B2 or other instances where people have successfully set up large federated networks that can do dynamic queries of databases securely, and that with the idea that, you know, you were distributing the queries across the network. Now, that the standards then, you know, become a little bit of a different type of a an issue for that. But I think
don't mistake the notion that there's a server sitting inside the hospital in that image as if that is denoting a physical software deployment architecture. You know, I2B2 done some work with Query Health. In fact, some of what we're doing with Saner is derived from some of that Query Health work. And mm-hmm. and the notion is that there might be, you know, a cloud-based connection to that server that the hospital has to be able to communicate that data on that might be a segmented repository where each hospital sort of have its own virtual view of its data, but it could all be cloud based.
Well,
let's see if there are any other questions left. Let's see if there's other questions from the group, and if not, I've got one. Just because we're going to run out of time here in a couple of minutes. Well, I don't see any other hands, so Keith, let me give you a quick one. Given that there are multiple paths that this data might reach an aggregator, it might have gotten aggregated locally, then at state level, then at national level, and then there might be a different path where it goes straight to national. Does the standard contemplate a way to deduplicate the data so that you can say, I've already seen that data, I'm not going to sum it up inappropriately?
So
that makes sense.
That gets into, yes, that does make sense. It's a challenge that we often see, for example, in trying to reconcile problems, image, and allergies when you've got data coming in from multiple CCDA documents from across multiple sources and from inside the EHR as well, and plenty of duplication. There's a couple of keys to that. One of that is being able to have provenance information, to be able to tell you who the data source was and potentially be able to trace that back. And then the other aspect of that is that level, the ability to incorporate line level information so that you can potentially just record, say, record identifiers associated with the accounts, and be able to use that to trace back and be able to support the deduplication. Honestly, it is a that sort of topic is a really deep topic in terms of how you'd potentially, for example, take data from the state of New York and be able to factor out data from the city of New York, because maybe you already received that from the city of New York and there could potentially be overlaps in that. It's a pretty deep topic. I'll sort of rely on Les Leonard's, we aren't ready to boil that ocean yet.
Yeah.
Just a great question.
I'm always ready to boil the ocean. I just want a nuclear weapon when I do it.
Yeah. Just be thinking about it when you define your data elements, as much provenance as possible, because it could lead to a catastrophic mistake if an assumption about bed availability turns out to be the same bed got counted three times. Obviously. How about other questions from the group? Maybe we'll go for another few minutes here, and then we'll pick back up with our task force agenda. Any other questions from folks who haven't had a chance yet? Don't be shy.
All right.
While other people are thinking, I've got one other question for you, Keith. Who's the competition for successful adoption of this? Is it just the fax machine, or are there other, Les has put a quasi-competitor on the table, if you would, in the sense of leveraging existing HL7 V2 feeds. are there proprietary approaches that are moving into the space that will be likely successful or not successful? What's going to stop this from succeeding?
So what we're seeing right now is that there are a number of states that are currently supporting reporting, say, through Jivari or through other deployments for their emergency operations center, where that's the connectivity that exists today for this. And they've all got their own way of communicating. Matter of fact, Jivari's got two different products and two different protocols to support that capability. And not really to pick on any one organization either. It's just what I know. So that's one part of it, is that there's this sort of break between what happens in emergency operations and that channel of communication and what happens elsewhere in health IT. We've also previously mentioned HAVE, which maybe has more adoption at the international level. I know there's a feed still running in New York from one New York hospital to HERDS, but that data is not being used for COVID-19 reporting. It's sort of sad that they don't turn that one off. That has the challenge that it's not getting at the other data that's needed, the ventilators, the deaths, and the 100 or so different questions that are being asked at the state and or federal level for this. Les mentioned ADT. ADT has its own set of challenges. And, as we said, we did a report for ASPR that identified one of them. But one of those is just within an ADT stream, like you have to get and deal with the deduplication challenge because you get the same admin several times because maybe it didn't get sent or you didn't receive an acknowledgement and so it got sent again. Then you have to look at all of the transitions of a patient got admitted, they got moved, this thing happened, that thing happened, they changed class from being outpatient under observation to inpatient to finally getting discharged, and does that all line up to give you what you need to actually be able to count occupied beds, which says nothing about your capacity because you just converted OR3 to an ICU that supports six patients. And now you have additional capacity that never shows up in that ADT feed until it starts to get used.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for that. Arianne, back to you. You want to wrap this up? And we can move to our priority agenda.
Yeah, no, so first of all, a really beautiful presentation. I see Clem has a question.
Good.
Why don't we get Clem, is it a quick question? Because we do have to wrap up and go to prioritization.
No, it wasn't a question, it was just a comment that for deduplication, FHIR does have a unique key that's supposed to be persistent all wherever it goes. And it should solve the problem, but I don't know if it's really implemented well or if anybody's using it, but just be aware of that. And one other thing is I didn't get the name of this new product that was competing with ADT, or the new standard. What's the name?
It's called Saner, Clem.
No, the other one.
Oh, that was...
You mentioned Jivari or Jivari, and that's what I thought Clem was asking, but maybe
Jivari.
He was after Saner.
Saner is the HL7 standard you're talking, right?
Yep.
That's right.
Yeah. Jivari is one of many vendors in the emergency operations space.
Okay. Thank you.
Jivari. I gave you the spelling in chat.
I got it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Lauren and Keith, thank you very much for a very well done and very insightful presentation.
Yes.
And thanks for the two of you and for Scott for jumping on in short notice and giving us a situational awareness as to the situational awareness project. So we're going
to go. I'll be happy to stay on if you think there's going to be any public questions I might need to.
Well, yeah, you're obviously welcome. You're obviously welcome, and it's a public meeting. So we're going to transition now to primarily talking about some of the voting that we did in prioritizations. We did this a little bit out of order, but that's fine. So a number of people submitted their. Let's go to the next slide and just review the prioritization process. So as noted, we put together a variety of major areas coming out of our previous conversation. You can see them here. I won't go through all of them. We've deferred the vaccine credentials project because ONC's already picking that project up. And so the remainder, whatever it is, 11 or 12 projects are under prioritization scope. If we go on to the next slide. We put together a prioritization approach where we looked at overall priority, potential impact, existence of policy levers, and the current burden of existing approaches, and an overall scoring system for high, medium, and low that overweights highs relative to mediums relative to lows. And we submitted a scoring email, and then I went through and typed up, I believe I captured everybody's input, as well as David and my input. I think there's some people who weren't able to provide their input, but we rolled up to a broader scoring presentation. So if we go to the next, here is how the current weights roll out, and so you can see the distribution of highs, mediums, and lows for each of the areas. And then we did a simple even-weighted sum across the average of each of the priorities. So again, we weighted the priorities according to weighting mechanism you saw previously, which is an exponential weighting mechanism, a nine counts, you know, a high counts for nine, a medium counts for a three, a low counts for a one. We weighted those together and put together a weighted average for each of these areas. It's actually a weighted, anyway, it's not quite a weighted average, but it's a weighted sum across this. We then sum that up to a summation column, and what you can see is that, and we did this prior to scheduling any of these reviews, but just for discussion purposes, what we saw was that there were two very clear top priorities, which are health equity standards and the EHR data use flat fire real world evidence comparative effectiveness recovery type uses for data that scored in the 40s. Health equity clearly scores at the top, and then there's a cluster in the middle, in the mid 30s to mid 20s, relative to chronic to care plans, immunization registry reporting, data sharing between federal, commercial, clinical, administrative data standards, and harmonization and burden reduction, and syndromic surveillance. And then a cluster sort of below 20 for contact and exposure notification, situational awareness, adverse event reporting, and patient device. And so we want to have a discussion here about whether this emergent ranking based on individual voting passes a sniff test. We should contemplate running forward with these as our priorities. And then I'd also note that there are some people who didn't have an opportunity to vote. I think we're more than happy to take votes in. What we noticed was that if you think about a sensitivity analysis, so far the top two results have been relatively robust, and then the rank order in the next five has been relatively non-robust. So it, the rank order bounces up and down, but that that group of five seems to be relatively robust, and the group of four at the bottom seems to be relatively robust. That obviously could change because we have low N so far. That obviously could change if we get more votes. So I think we're more than willing to get more votes in. But I just wanted to throw out, whether the priority ranking here passes the sniff test, and how we would contemplate moving forward. So if we just took this as handed from on high guidance, we would say, well, we should go all guns blazing for the first two. We should do appropriate work for the next five, and then we should get around to the bottom four when we have time to get around to them if we think about prioritization order. So I'm just going to pause, and I see Clem's got his hand up, but really look for folks to raise their hands and chip in terms of overall prioritization. And this is not the avenue for arguing that your priority that you thought was high ranked low and that's bad. More just from an aggregate perspective, do we feel like we ended up in a place that seems sensible? So Clem, go ahead.
Well, I'm just not clear on what a technical health equity standard is. I can see the attraction to having health be equally distributed, but where does it fit in technical standards? And it's maybe one of the ones I asked about the other day. I got it, but I didn't get it.
Yeah, no, I think I appropriately in the email that we sent out for voting. I think I appropriately glossed it. So if you go back to that email and refer back to it, we did, I think, appropriately gloss the email. But we're really talking about both SDOH, so sort of the output of the Gravity Project, so additional information on social determinants of health, and then basic demographic information attached to various flows, looking at race, ethnicity, gender, and basic demographic information like geolocation, zip code, or census tract information.
Okay, thank you.
And I believe, Clem, I believe next week's session we'll hear from the Gravity Project, and they can expand on some of those details. That's our current plan for.
Yeah, and I also, as I was explaining the averages, I think I understand what I did that makes these averages a little bit bizarre. So I'm more than happy to go back and clean up the math and see if that changes the rankings. I doubt it will, but the average really should be below 9. Let me go back and do another pass at doing the Excel wizardry to make all these things count up appropriately. I averaged across the sum of the high, medium, and low, as opposed to averaging across all the values. So we'll work it through. And
that one of the things here was to get a sort of a driving sense of where we should put effort on learning more about these categories. But that as we learn more, we may revisit some of what we thought was important or not important, based on discovery. So this is, I think at this stage of the game, the way I'm looking at this is it's a prioritization for our discovery work, which may get revisited in terms of final priorities presented as recommendations from the task force to ONC. Hopefully those align closely, but this potential, like, I don't think we knew a whole lot about SANR before today's presentation. Now that we know more, that might affect the way people would prioritize that work. So that's probably going to change with others of these domains once we get more input.
That's exactly right. All right, other questions on the ranking? And as I said, we're more than happy to get additional votes and rerun this and see how robust they are to additional data. When you have low ends, you sometimes get wacky results. So the more people who vote, the better off, the more robust the priority ranking will be. All right, so hearing no other questions, I think the conclusion that we would have is that our next priorities for hearing from the community would be primarily around health equity standards. And as David mentioned, we're already lined up with the Gravity project and then the cluster of EHR data use relative to real-world evidence or comparative effectiveness or recovery-like kind of comparative effectiveness trial, emergent trial design work. This is the long mythical learning health system that we've all wanted to get to. And David, remind me where we are with that one. I think there's some folks we reached out to who we'd like to get additional.
I think the next slide has our current status on that. Can we try the next one? Yeah, here we go. So in the black font are the ones we've already lined up. We heard obviously from Sainer just a few minutes ago, health equity is queued up for next week. We have conversations underway in these other four areas. I've got a call tomorrow with one of the key players in the Flatfire standards and profiling space to get suggestions for that category in the third position there, that learning health system leverage EHR data. I'm hoping that after the call I have tomorrow, we'll have some specific names for people that we could invite either on the 8th or the subsequent week. We have conversations underway in the other three areas as well with requested feedback from folks, but we haven't slotted them into a session. We're certainly open for suggestions. I can tell you on the federal, non-federal boundary question, I've had a long conversation with Scott Stewie from Direct Trust and now have a better understanding of what the status of that problem is and advances that have been made that we might not have been aware of. But I think we'll still probably get some expert opinion about what is yet to be solved for that space. Arian, you have other comments. You are going to, I think, the administrative and clinical data standards was your
Chase. I did reach out, and I think we got a favorable response. And we just need to line up better. And I've been remiss. I've been remiss in Slack on that one. So we'll work through that. But I do think we should prioritize health equity and real world comparative effectiveness to make sure we get at least good presentations there.
Yeah, we're well underway on that one. On those two.
Any other comments from the group in terms of other folks you'd like to hear from, just hearing that overall prioritization process, other folks you'd like to hear from, other input we'd like to be able to do?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to hear from OHDSI, so you were going to bring down one of the leaders from that. For the real-world effectiveness data, but also from BCornet. So I would urge you to think about both of those as potential standards for real-world effectiveness data, and then focusing on how we produce those from other standardized data sets like FHIR, for example.
Les, if you want to send me some suggestions for BCornet, we'd appreciate that. Just email them to me or speak them out loud if you have them right on your head, top of your head. I've got an OHSDI thought, but we haven't made contact yet. But I have names, obviously, George Rupsack.
I know George pretty well, so if you want me to reach out to him. I think it's an interesting question who's to reach out to about the Cornet, but now that it's been taken back in the agency, inside the, not an agency, but something, it's close to that. Probably someone in BCornet would be the right person to talk about. So I can poke that around that. If nothing else, we can also get Star or One Florida or somebody like that to talk about their BCornet installations.
Okay.
All right.
Clem, your hand is up. Is Clem's hand up a leftover?
Nope. I think Clem is officially got his hand up.
Yeah.
No, I just want to bring about the Cornet. We're working with some of the data, and I just want to compliment it. But I thought that Duke was the organizing center, and there's a guy named Keith. I've lost his name, but who would know all about it? But I don't know if that's still true, Leslie. I thought Duke was the coordinating center. There's a guy there who runs it.
Yeah, Duke is the coordinating center, but sometimes we could go to the coordinating center, but the coordinating center really does mainly coordinate in that. So, but that's fine. Whoever, you know.
Well, just they know a lot about it. In case you just wanted an overview, I'm not trying to push.
I mean,
anyone.
Yeah, I'm pretty neutral, as I said, that the number of direct as a you know our I am the institutional lead for PCornet at MUSC, and so I whatever. Yeah, that was just Duke could be great too. They'll tell us all about the global nature of it and those things there. That
yeah.
I think the data quality assessment is really the you know both of those. OHDSI and PCornet really distinguish themselves by having systematic testing of the data for quality. And that might be an important part of any standard would be to define what those measures are.
Interesting.
And they're both pretty well standardized with code. So the PCornet has over 9 billion test results mapped to Linux. It just was striking. Was that many?
Yeah, they're has about 100 million people.
So this has been good just in terms of thinking about who we want to speak to. Let's wait a little while before we go super deep into the weeds. Keith, I see you got your hand up. We got 1 minute before public comment, so if you have a 1 minute comment, go for it. As a guest.
Well, it was really for public comment. Looking back at your rating slide. And wasn't really able to tell whether people could give out an unlimited number of high, medium, and lows or not. I find that if you've got ranking like high, medium, and low, and people can just mark that on specific things, that it's best if you sort of make them make decisions and say, well, you can award three of these and five of these, and the rest fit into this bucket. Just in terms of getting them to make decisions about where things fit, putting everybody sort of on the same scale so that you don't necessarily have one person ranking a bunch of things high. I don't know if that's something that you applied to that or not.
We did. So thank you for the comment. We definitely did. We weren't super heavy-handed about it, but we at least saw some separation. So, and I assume that separation is going to survive some of the redoing that we do. But you know, clearly, the next stage after if you don't get separation is to force people to rank order as well. So there are definitely tricks that we can do to force separation. Why don't we go to public comment?
All right, operator, could we please open up the line for public comment?
Yes. If you would like to make a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we pull for comments. There are no comments at this time.
Thank you.
Okie doke. So we can go to additional discussion, or we can give each other back 4 whole minutes to check email and use the facilities. Okay, it sounds like people have voted for the 4 whole minutes. So thank you very much. I think I won't be able to attend next meeting. David's going to ably lead us through the Gravity presentation, and if you haven't voted, please do vote, and we'll make sure that your priorities get represented and we get to a final version of prioritization, or an interim version of prioritization, as David said, contingent on or prior to hearing all the presentations.
Thanks Keith and Lauren.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for having us.
Very good.
Okie doke. Bye-bye.